what's, what do you have today? Yeah.
Is there a movement that regarding the blood, is there a movement required to down all three shackles?
Right. So, yeah.
And the Gemara says one, no, and then some people say once, and then the Mishnah, I think, says it twice.
Yeah, yeah. So let me just explain the background. We start off with a general principle that has many exceptions, that women are normally exempt from time-bound commandments. And as a result, the Mishnah says a woman is exempt from reading the Shema. So a woman does not have to read the Shema twice a day because that's a time-bound commandment, although it's proper for a woman to at least say the first pasuk because she's accepting God's sovereignty. But the Mishnah then says that although a woman is exempt from Shema, she is obligated in tefillah, which means Shemona Esrei. Now there's a big machlokas Rishonim, how to understand that passage. And I have to backtrack a little bit by introducing you, maybe you've gone over this already, to an argument between Rambam, Maimonides, and Ramban, Nachmanides, as to whether there's a mitzvah in the Torah to daven every day. According to Rambam, there is actually a mitzvah from the Torah to pray to Hashem every single day, but the Da'oraisa mitzvah is once a day, not three times a day, and in your own words. The idea of the three prayers and the idea of a Shemona Esrei is rabbinic. So according to the Rambam, there's what you might call a two-tier system of prayer. There is the Torah-level prayer, which is, help me God, and then there's the rabbinic prayer, which is the Shemona Esrei. Ramban, Nachmanides, argues with that assumption, and Nachmanides argues that there is no daily requirement to pray to God at all. When you're in trouble, you pray to Hashem, but there's no requirement normally. And all of prayer is rabbinic. Now, based on this general understanding, we now have two interpretations of the Gemara. According to Maimonides' interpretation, women are obligated on Torah-level prayer because it's not time-bound, because you can daven any time of the day, but they're not obligated in rabbinic prayer. So according to Maimonides, a woman does not have to daven a daily Shemona Esrei even one time, but she has to say to God some words of prayer. Some say, even Modani, help me God, Zemaspik, that would be enough. So according to Maimonides, women are obligated in Torah-level prayer, but they're not obligated in rabbinic prayer, because rabbinic prayer is time-bound. But Nachmanides, since he holds there's no such thing as Torah prayer, so behechrich, you have to say that when the Mishnah says they're obligated in rabbinic prayer because that's the only thing you have, right? So according to Nachmanides, a woman would have to daven two full amidos every day. Now the reason why not three is because even for a man, we paskin that the Maariv prayer was originally optional, and even though now it's a chiyuv because of custom, women never accepted the custom. So the Mishnah Berurah generally follows Ramban's shita and does advocate that a woman should daven two full Shemona Esreis. But it's important to know that the most common custom in Eastern Europe was that women would just recite their own Yiddish prayer in their own words. And even today, if a woman is burdened with raising children and the like, she can rely on that opinion. So that's the source of the disagreement. It really depends on how to interpret the passage in the Mishnah that women have to daven every day. And that depends in turn on the big argument between Rambam and Ramban, if there's a two-tier prayer system or only a single-tier prayer system. Okay, so that's the best. So Ramban would, in other words, it's interesting, Ramban, who says all prayer is rabbinic, he would actually be stricter for women because since he doesn't have a Torah-level prayer, the Mishnah must mean women are chayav in the full prayer. So Ramban would say women have to pray Shemon Esrei of morning and mincha, and Rambam would say that wouldn't be obligatory. And that would be the basis of the argument. Yeah?
What's the idea behind the Shem, like for the sake of, like, do they have to, like, let's say you're
well, like, you know, like everything else, in spirituality, because God is infinite, spiritual levels are infinite. So obviously, if you wanted to do a mitzvah on the highest level of holiness, then every moment of the mitzvah you feel consciously that you're serving Hashem, communicating with Hashem. But in terms of the basic halacha, those commandments that need to be done lishma, l'shem, so basically if you think, you don't even have to say, if you think when you begin the mitzvah that you're doing it for the sake of God, that thought is going to cover you until you have a contrary thought that, God forbid, I'm not doing it for the sake of God. So according to the halacha, the pre-existing statement is going to be enough. In fact, this is even brought down in a bit of a strange context. You know, there is a halacha in all davening that whenever you say the name of God, you're supposed to be consciously thinking about a particular attribute. So when you say the Aleph, Dalet, and Yud, which is Yud, Kei, Vav, Kei, the four-letter name of God, you're supposed to think, Hoya, Hove, V'yeh. He's eternal. He was, he is, he will always be. When you say Elohim, you think, Bala Kochot Kulam, he is the master of all powers. And in some Siddurim, you'll actually see that printed. Every time Hashem's name is mentioned, Hashem or Elohim, it'll have that thing mentioned. But it's brought down in Svarim, there's such an Eitzah, that if it's the beginning of the day, you simply say, every time I say this, I'm going to mean this. And every time I say this, I'm going to mean this. So with the Eved, at least, that's going to cover every single mention of God's name. And it's also brought down in Poskim that that's a thing you can and should do if you feel you're not going to be consciously thinking about it all the time. But as I say, in Ruchnius and spirituality, there are infinite levels. So what you can get away with is not necessarily what you aspire to be. Yeah.
Rabbi, what about what about God from Abraham?
You mean after Havdalah?
Before
Havdalah, Motzei Shabbos?
Yeah, that's in Yiddish.
Well, yeah, I don't know how many people are familiar with this. This is a very, very beautiful prayer. Gott von Avram, God of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, that countless generations of people, particularly Jewish women, but men also, recite before Havdalah. In fact, if you look at, I think the Archical Siddur may even have it, I'm not sure, and some people have given Hebrew translations or English translations and the like. You know, look at it. You know, it's something that's very beautiful. It's not. It's not an obligation, in any way. No, it's not an obligation. But it was done in Europe. In fact, it was composed. Yeah, it was composed by a very, very famous Hasidish Rebbe, the famous Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. Right. Oh. I'm sure many people have heard of the Berdichever. There are so many beautiful stories about how much he loved the Jewish people. You know, I'll give you one story in particular. That he once went up to a Jew who was smoking on Shabbos and says, you know, Reb Yid, do you know that it's Shabbos today? He says, yeah, I do. He says, do you know that you're not allowed to smoke on Shabbos? He says, yeah, I do. So he seems to be a chutzpahdik, very arrogant sinner. Because the Bedichurer says to Hashem, he says, Hashem, look at how much your people always tell the truth. Even when the rabbi catches them on Shabbos, they want to tell truth. What a truthful, honest people, you know. You should have blessing on them. And you know, there are like hundreds of stories about this. So he is the one who actually composed that prayer. So that itself makes it worth a look, as it were. If it was Yiddish, obviously, because like you said, it was written, it was the vernacular. So if you were to say it in English, or if that's your language, you know, that would be perfectly fine by too. But it's not an obligation. So, yeah.
Well, when you say in prayer you have to think about the different attributes of God every time you say the name.
Yeah.
Is it more so like thinking of like the individual words that it stands for, like a visualization of what it could be, or like a feeling that it gives?
Yeah, well, visualization is a risky and a bit of a controversial issue because, as you know, the Torah itself tells us over and over again, remember that at Sinai you did not see an image, you did not see a picture, right? It's fundamental to us that Hashem does not have a physical and material form. I'll discuss the issue of visualization shortly, but the simple idea is that when you think of characteristics, you think of God, His mercy, His power, right? So, you know, what does mercy look like? In other words, these are not things that you visualize in a concrete way, but you think in your own life. You know, God gives me life. I'm able to breathe. I'm able to see. You know, God has the infinite power over the universe. So you can visualize things, but you're not visualizing God. You're visualizing manifestations of power, manifestations of mercy, manifestations of kindness. Now, whether you're allowed to engage in any visualization of God is a very, very controversial issue. I would recommend not to do it at all, but in some Sipri Hasidus, such a concept is there as long as you absolutely understand that it's a symbolic idea. So you think of the merciful grandfather, so to speak, and then you say, oh, God is infinitely more. But as I say, that's a bit of a very controversial practice, so we would normally not talk about that. But again, to be honest, there are some svarim that do allow that in some ways. Okay, anything else? Short session today. Everything's clear. Yeah.
And then, what is it to say? Supposed to say like a bracha levatala, and then are informed we're not supposed to send them Hashem in vain.
Right.
But then there are some brachas, the long ones, that they start and end the bracha with the same. It's almost like saying the name of Hashem in vain. So.
Well, yeah. So you have to understand that the official structure of a bracha actually is supposed to begin with Baruch Atah Hashem. And it ends with Baruch Hashem. That is the nature of a bracha. One is called Pesicha, opening, and one is called Chasima, conclusion. And in point of fact, every time we make a bracha that doesn't have that format, you know, we always have to look in the Talmud and the Rishonim why we don't. In other words, the standardization of a bracha is actually a beginning with a baruch and an ending with a baruch. And that's not called in vain, because that is the way HaKadosh Baruch was appropriately praised, beginning and end. Now, why we don't do that? So if it's a short bracha, you know, it's like shako, you know, it's not big enough for a beginning and an end. But in Shemoneh Esrei, for example, a very simple question. Look at the first blessing of the Amidah. The first blessing of the Amidah does follow our official format, with one little exception. Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu Elokei Avoseinu, and then it ends with Baruch atah Hashem, Magen Avraham. Begins with Baruch atah, and ends with Baruch atah. So we will call the first blessing of Shemoneh Esrei is the official format. Now, even then, let me just digress for a moment. Even then, there is something atypical about that bracha. Can anyone think, what is unusual? This is a hard question, but maybe you'll get it. What is
19,
huh? Well, 19. That's like, yeah, in the whole matter. But I'm just talking about just looking at the first bracha. Yes, because in a standard bracha, you don't just say Hashem. You always say Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam, Melech Ha'olam. And in fact, the Gemara in Brachos teaches us a bracha must have Shem, the name of God. And it must also combine it with Melech Ha'olam. So the big question is that the first bracha of Shemoneh Esrei does not mention Melech Ha'olam. That would invalidate it as a bracha. But Chazal explained that by mentioning Avraham Avinu, who brought God into the world and brought people to the worship of God, it's considered a functional equivalent to Melech HaOlam, because Avraham made Hashem the Melech HaOlam. Right, so that's okay. But that's, be it as may, putting Malchus aside, begins with Baruch and ends with Baruch. Now, every other bracha is very different. It ends with a Baruch, but it doesn't begin with a Baruch, right? Every other one, the other 18 blessings. Why is that so? So here we have a very interesting Talmudic concept that's a little complicated, and it's hard to apply. You have to go through the whole Siddur to see if we're consistent in this. And that is, there is a concept that any bracha that is always adjacent to another bracha, it kind of lives off the structure of the first bracha. You don't have to begin with a Baruch Atah, because since it's always connected, the Baruch Atah of the first bracha will kind of serve, right? So bracha number 2 is connected to bracha number 1, so it doesn't need its own Baruch Atah. Bracha number 3 is connected to 2, which is connected to 1. Bracha 19 is connected to 18, which is connected to 17, etc. So that's called bracha samucha lechaverta. A bracha that is always adjacent to another bracha doesn't need its own opening Baruch Atah Hashem. That also explains why, let's say, Psukei Dezimra, right, the praises to God that we say before Baruch Hu, Pesukei Dezimra from Tehillim. So that has a before bracha, which is Baruch Sha'amar. And Baruch Sha'amar does have standard, Baruch Atah Hashem, and it ends with Baruch Atah, right? But the ending bracha of Pesukei Dezimra is Yishtabach, that ends with the Baruch Atah Hashem, but it doesn't begin, because even though you have all the Tehillim in the middle, since Yishtabach is always recited in tandem with Baruch Sha'amar, we apply the rule of Bracha Samucha L'Chaberta. Yeah. So it's complicated. We really, literally, one needs to go through the whole Siddur to see how this rule works, but that's essentially how it works. So the point I'm making is that the norm of a Bracha is to begin and end with a Baruch, and everything else is a deviation. Now, it may be the exceptions are more than the rule. You're right. But technically, all of them are exceptions that have to be explained. The rule doesn't have to be explained, because that is actually the standardization of a bracha. Yeah.
What would you classify as a challenge of why Haredim avoid the bracha?
Well, this is a very, very tough question. And certainly, the need to defend the Jewish people is a very, very important need. And one thing I would say, and I've said it many times, and you know other people agree, greater people have said it before me, is that a Jewish person who joins the army and is willing to possibly give his life for the defense of the Jewish people is worthy of great, great respect and admiration and gratitude, even if they're not religious otherwise. And we do have a chiyuv of hakara satov. But the short answer is that we believe that ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world and God governs the world. Now, if someone doesn't believe in God, it's a little harder to make the argument. And if we believe that it's not our military victory alone or our military prowess alone that will give us victory and success, but only if Hashem gives us bracha, then we understand that although you need an army and you need soldiers and people have to fight and we have to be very, very grateful, but Torah study is also absolutely necessary. Without the Torah study, we don't have the merit, we don't have the blessing, we don't have any assurance from God that he's going to help us. So basically, the Haredi world has two arguments. Argument number one is that people who are able, not everybody is able, some Haredim should go into the army, and we have Nachal Haredi, but those who are able and willing to commit themselves to full-time Torah, they are not shirking their responsibilities. They are contributing in a great, great way to the spiritual bracha of Klal Yisrael and ultimately even the physical survival. So that's one argument. Now, the second argument is more of a technical argument, but I think it does apply. And that is, if the army is not set up properly to allow people to live a full religious life of Torah and mitzvah, so parents are rightfully afraid that their children will be exposed to immorality and lack of kashrus properly and the like. Now, that's a technical problem in the sense that theoretically, if things got better, that might change. But in the world that we're living in, the army is not such a good environment. Now, are there religious people who go to the army who keep up their level? Yes, there are. There absolutely are. So it's not going to be that you have, but on the other hand, it's a very hard challenge, and some people are not up to that challenge, and as a result, they shouldn't be forced to do it. Now, let me point out that in the press, there's a lot of misconceptions here, because you get the impression in the press that every Israeli is serving in a combat unit except Haredim that shirk their duty. First of all, remember that the exemption of non-religious people from military service approaches 40%, meaning there's all sorts of people who get excused from military service for all sorts of reasons. You're going to college, you know, whatever it is. So this is not just religious people are the only people who don't serve in the army. Second of all, although once again, the people who serve in combat units are real heroes. And again, I have great, great admiration. But many people who serve in the army have office jobs. They're working in libraries, they're working in kitchens, they're working in latrines, meaning it's not like every secular Israeli is risking their life for the Jewish people except the Haredim. So if we understood, or if people understood, that Torah study is contributing to the national service, then, once again, it's not that people are shirking their duty, people are fulfilling their duty in this particular way. Now, with all of this, I do want to say that there are Haredim in the army, more than you would think. There is Nachal Haredi. So, unfortunately, what happens in Israel, and I'm not a fan of this, is that everything gets escalated into World War II or World War III, not two, World War III, World War IV, meaning every issue gets debated as if, you know, the Chilonim are trying to utterly destroy us and we have to fight back. And the truth of the matter is that the real problem is the element of coercion. In other words, many of our Gedolim do recognize that not everybody is cut out for full-time intensive learning. And for many people, the army would be the right thing for them. It would train them for a job and the like. And on a volunteer level, you know, Rosh Yeshivas are willing and happy to make individual decisions about people, which may result in more parnasa and may result in the army. What is getting people so excited is the notion that how the government is going to step in and say only X number of people can stay in yeshiva. So really, it's the coercion idea that is much, much worse. Now, the dirty little secret is the army does not want a lot of Haredim in the army. The army doesn't want it. They don't want it at all. Number one, it's going to make life too difficult. They're going to come in and change the kashrus and everything else. Number two, there is no military need for it at all. So this is not a security issue. This really is not a military security issue. This is a homogenization issue, meaning there are elements in Israeli society that want to kind of make everybody the same cultural mix. And that, in turn, is something that many Haredim find very, very offensive, that essentially somebody's looking down at them and saying, hey, you got to live in the 21st century. Become modern like everybody else. And once again, if it would have been a security issue, that's a very, very different thing, because Chazal do say, when the Jewish people are sakana, everybody participates in the military struggle. But numerically, it really is not a security issue. As the army the officials will themselves say, it's really a, what you call, and the English phrase is, it's a social engineering issue. And that's a very, very different issue. So now, if somebody doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in Torah, etc., it's very hard to give them a purely secular argument. What can I tell you? We're dealing with two different mindsets. But what I could pull out to you is that, you know, I was in yeshiva during the Vietnam War. And some of you, the older folks, would remember the Vietnam War in the United States. And it is true that the yeshivas vastly expanded their population during the Vietnam War, and so there was some draft dodging involved. But let me just point out that the United States of America, even during World War II, which was a true national emergency, never drafted full-time theological students, meaning even time of an actual world war, it was understood that those who were, I mean, there are people who volunteered, but you didn't draft people that were involved in preparing to be rabbis and teachers or priests or whatever it would be. So in that sense, you know, even secular societies recognize that we need people who were involved in spiritual teaching. Okay, but as I say, it's not so much opposition to the army, it's opposition to a coercive program that is not allowing the flexibility of religious people to make the choice that is best.
Since we're talking about it, before the Dachshund, maybe I might be mistaken, but the army didn't have kosher Shabbos or like Rabbanim or option for tefillah. But when they came, all that changed, and now they have kosher, now they have Shabbos off.
Yes.
And it's like well known that the Haredi learn much better and are much, you know. So couldn't Kal Vachomer, if by joining the army they could do so much more good, like by the...
You know, listen, I mean, that does raise a very, very good question, and I'm not going to dismiss it, so it may very well be so, but, you know, in a sense, this is a variation of a question that we always face, meaning, should I live in a religious neighborhood, or maybe should I live in a non-religious neighborhood where I might be a positive influence? The downside is, maybe there'll be negative influences on my kids. Right? Should I move to Muncie or Lakewood, or should I move to a Peoria or Montana, where I could be, you know? And, you know, those are difficult questions, because you always have to weigh the potential that you can do good with the potential that you might be dragged down. There's no question that the Hester student body from the Datilum Yeshivas have done a tremendous amount of sanctification of God's name, and they've made the army more, still not, it's not quite complete, but they certainly made it much more hospitable to religious life. But at the same time, there are studies that have shown that a number of Datilum Yeshiva graduates have suffered in religious observance, right? So you're going to find examples in both ways, and each person has to make the judgment, am I strong enough? Am I firm enough? Am I going to be a positive influence, or will I be negatively influenced? So once again, the only answer I can give you is, that's a decision that has to be made through a spiritual introspection in consultation with one's spiritual teachers, and it shouldn't be something that the government automatically decides, we're only going to allow 100 people or 500 people to do it. So in principle, you're 100% right. I'll just go back to the idea that the government shouldn't be in the business of mandating these types of things. Yeah?
On the one hand, we have this option, and on the other hand, we have this. Where did that originate? Can it be traced to a single person?
No, this is the characteristic of Jewish thinking. It's really the process of the oral law. If anything, we'll trace it to the Gemara. Now, the Gemara itself wasn't invented. The Gemara itself has things that were handed down from Moshe. But even a secular Jew, you see, this is how deeply Torah patterns of thinking have permeated. Even a Jew who hasn't, you know, whose family hasn't looked at the Talmud for, you know, 200 years, absorbs this dialectic that everything has multiple sides. It's really a recognition. Theologically, it's based on the infinity of God. Because God is infinite, he encompasses the totality of reality. And in the totality of reality, there's going to be contradiction. There's going to be paradox. There are going to be many, many ways. Only superficial people, so to speak, see one side of a question. A richer, deeper intelligence sees many, many sides of the question, and I would have to say that this is the inheritance of Talmudic study.
What about the gesture?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. You mean the...
Yeah, and the voice.
You know, I don't have a detailed study, but I would clearly say it's an Ashkenazic thing, because Svardim didn't inherently have that, although, because they've been in Ashkenazic yeshivas, they do it too. So I'll see if I can find some research on it. It's certainly, that is not as old. That, I would say, is Eastern European, and it might be connected. I guess what would be interesting to see is it connected even to what was done in non-Jewish cultures? Because Yiddish, let's take Yiddish. You know, Yiddish is a fascinating hybrid language. Yiddish has a lot of Hebrew and Aramaic in it, to be sure, but at its core, it's German, and then there's other Slavic ideas. So sometimes gestures and the like are assimilated from the particular countries that Jews lived in. So I'll see if I can find out something. It's an interesting question. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
Good question. One thing that I've been wondering about, I guess on the Ashkenazi kind of note, is that when I first got here, I went down to the hotel.
Yes.
And I noticed there's a lot of people in Russian clothes and Polish clothes and acting Jewish. And I thought, we are so against being assimilated, why don't we have more of a Jewish authenticity?
Now, let me ask you, when you say Russian clothes and clothes, are they referring to
the
strimals. Oh, I see. In other words, what is now distinctively Jewish, but yes, in its origin,
yeah,
may have been.
The rest of the world looks at it, you know, from an outside point of view. I didn't grow up Jewish at all. I didn't know anything about it. So when I did learn about it,
yeah,
I saw this, I was shocked. I was like, I thought we left this in the countries that pushed
yeah.
it on.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is a bit of controversy, meaning the common origin that you're describing, that the shtreimel, the fur hat, some say, you know, either they were the garments of the Polish nobility, or the Poles made us wear these animal hats to humiliate us, and you know, I just want to point out that not all scholars, you know, do agree with that particular origin. Some do give them a distinctly Jewish origin, in which case your problem wouldn't be much of a problem. But I think there is an idea, too, that if you accept that this was something to shame the Jew, in a sense, it's like wearing a yellow star. Do you remember during World War II, the Nazis made Jews wear a yellow star? So you may recall that in Denmark, the king of Denmark, who of course was a Christian, wanted to show his solidarity with the Jewish people, so he insisted on wearing a yellow star. There were other righteous Gentiles who did the same thing. And in a sense, sometimes when you want to affirm your pride in being Jewish, you kind of say to this culture, you were trying to shame me, you were trying to humiliate me. The very thing you thought was such a shame, I am affirming as my pride. So I think that might be kind of it as well. Now, what also happens, and this is a matter of more sociology than religion, is that things get unhitched from their origins, meaning to say a shtreimel today is obviously not an attempt to imitate what non-Jews do, because there are no non-Jews who wear shtreimels. So it could very well be, are they again? Mongolians wear shtreimels? Is that like a winter hat, or are they just how they do it? Okay, well, you know, if it's something protection from the cold, you could see Russian hats, you know, resemble a shtreimel in some way, but it's not worn as formal, I think, formal dress at a party or a wedding or something. But as I say, certainly you have to look at the particular intention. The person who wears a shtreimel today is making a self-conscious decision that I want to be identified with a very religious, fervent group.